Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Life is full of awesome what ifs and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You know, if you've got somebody like Jeannie Flynn, who was the first pilot, first woman fighter pilot, you got somebody like that coming out the very top of her pilot training class, what commander wouldn't want her flying a fighter for him, right? Or her. Yeah. So it just makes sense that you put the best people in the job.
Welcome to the Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. If you are in the US, next week, the 23rd of May, 2023, is publication day for Eileen Bjorkman's fantastic new book, The Fly Girls Revolt. Now, this is the story of the women who forced the change to allow women to fly combat for the US Air Force. The thing is, there's always been women in combat. But over the last sort of century and a half, there's been much hand-wringing by men, mainly in the West, about whether it's suitable for women to be involved in roles that could put them in harm's way. During times of crisis and war, women have answered the call, only to be shunted back at the end of hostilities into less frontline roles. While this has been true of all arms of the military, in air forces, this line is pretty blurry, even at the best of times. Does combat mean a combat-capable aircraft or actually firing weapons? Well, from the WASPs back in the Second World War through to women on the front line of today, the US Air Force's journey has seen groups of remarkable women kick the door wider for each generation until skill and competence are the only requirements that are required to fly. So I'm delighted to welcome Eileen to the show. So to start my conversation, we need to start really with the WASPs and with a woman that led them, who has an oversized reputation. But the real question is, who was Jackie Cochran?
Yes, so she was a very renowned pilot in the 1930s. She started air racing in the 1930s and eventually won what was called the Bendix Race, which was kind of a big race in the United States at the time. Back in those days, you know, racing was huge. It made front page news, you know, whereas now it's kind of buried in the back section somewhere if it gets, you know, mentioned at all. So, but it was a big deal in those days. And she, like I said, had become, you know, very influential in aviation. And the fact that she was a woman, you know, of course, made her stand out somewhat. So a lot of people, and she also was married to a billionaire, which didn't hurt. So, yeah. And so she had access to a lot of people that, you know, an average, you know, woman aviator in those days wouldn't have had access to, you know, like lunching with President Roosevelt and having access to his wife, and who was very, Eleanor Roosevelt was actually very interested in having women become pilots. And it was actually through that relationship that kind of got things started on the U.S. side of the house in terms of women becoming pilots during World War II.
So I guess the elephant in the room is things have happened a little bit faster in Europe, shall we say. As things have kicked off a bit, what influences are happening to the Army Air Force as it was then in regards to women and the roles that they would later take up within the Air Force as war would be declared in 41 for you guys?
So, you know, again, initially there was actually a big push in the United States starting in the late 30s to train pilots in general, to kind of start building a bench, if you will, of civilian pilots that could come into the military if needed. And so the Army Air Corps at that time, actually in the late 30s, early 40s, Jacqueline Cochran first talked with the Army Air Corps about potentially bringing, you know, women pilots in. There was sort of a lukewarm interest at that time. I think there was kind of a sense that, well, we've got enough men to go around. You know, there's enough pilots out there. And so we're not really going to need that. There were some people who were interested. They just wanted to bring in like onesies, twosies, you know, hire a few civilians here and there. And Jacqueline Cochran actually had a much bigger vision to have like a whole separate corps, kind of like they did in Europe, to bring in, you know, a whole bunch of women and have them be a separate entity. So
they were the WASPs, weren't they?
They were eventually called the WASP. They actually started out as two separate organizations in 1942. They were first there was a ferrying squadron that stood up, and the women who qualified for that ferrying squadron had to have 500 hours of flying time. They had to be commercially rated, multi-engine. They had to have a lot of experience. And so they were stood up initially, and they didn't need a lot of training. But there was also a large pool of women pilots in the country who, you know, maybe had like 50 hours or 100 hours of flying time. And so so Jacqueline Cochran actually took that pool of women and formed a training squadron or training organization. And about a year later, that was kind of unwieldy having these two separate organizations. And so at that time, they merged the two organizations in August of 1943 into what was then called the WASP.
Which I suppose we should say, what does WASP stand for? We just went straight to acronyms, and there's going to be a lot of those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that. So Women Air Force Service Pilots is what it stands for, yes.
And that's distinct from the Women's Air Force of its own. So that what would women be doing who wouldn't have been in Cochran's flying role?
So actually, there was no Women's Air Force at that time because there was no Air Force in the United States. So yeah, we were still part of the Army in those days. So yeah, and so there was the Women's Army Corps, which was called the WAC, and so women who were not in flying roles, you know, who were not working for the WASP or WASP pilots, would join the WAC. And it's interesting that the WAC, actually a significant number of women in the WAC served in the Army Air Corps. The Army Air Corps actually seemed in some ways more accepting of women and used them in a lot more of their roles than the actual, you know, Army side of things. So.
I have a unhealthy fascination with Hap Arnold, because his machinations to get his independent Air Force sort of played into a lot of the decisions he would make in command of the Army Air Force in the Second World War. What was his feeling with having women involved in the Air Force? Because he sort of seemed very keen and then not keen as things started playing out.
Initially, he was, you know, for it because, again, you know, he was waiting for the right time. You know, initially he didn't want to do it just because he was waiting for the right time. But after a while, it became apparent that women could play a big role in helping to free up men for combat positions. Mm-hmm. And so he was very supportive of the WASP initially. And he was actually the one who made the decision to form, you know, to merge the two organizations into one and put Jacqueline Cochran in charge. But as the war went on, it became harder and harder to justify the women, because there was no longer a shortage of male pilots. One of the good things that happened was that initially they thought the attrition rate of pilots flying overseas was going to be much higher. And, you know, luckily that turned out to not be the case. We still lost a lot of pilots, obviously, but at much lower rates than they expected. And so they had enough male pilots. And so it became harder and harder to justify the WASP, and eventually Congress voted to not allow them to militarize, even though Hap Arnold actually was in favor of that, and actually wound up disbanding them before the war even ended.
And the Women's Army Corps stayed in place.
Yes.
until when? Did they get disbanded at any point, or were they just wound down slowly after?
So they were wound down slowly. The original laws that were passed were because it wasn't just the women Army Corps. You also had the Navy, Coast Guard, mm-hmm. Marines, you know, all had their women auxiliaries. So so initially, all of those women's organizations were supposed to shut down six months after the end of the war was the original intent. So, you know, there was a realization that, you know, there was a lot of women in these organizations. You know, it's hard to just boot everybody out. You know, they needed a more orderly shutdown. So first there was that initial extension, but the military leadership liked the women. You know, they saw that, hey, these women played a very valuable role, and they were, in many cases, more educated than the men. They had fewer disciplinary problems. You know, there were good reasons to keep them around. And so the military leadership actually lobbied Congress to say, hey, could you put some laws in place to keep these women's groups around? You know, we don't need lots and lots of women. We're not at war anymore. But have a small cadre of women that are there so that if we do need them again, we've already got something to build on instead of starting from scratch like we did during World War II.
When I was reading this section of your book, I couldn't get Kim Hunter in A Matter of Life and Death out of my head, because she's the whack in the control tower that David Niven speaks to as his Lancaster gets lost in the fog on the way back. Okay. Yeah. All of my history sort of revolves around how I can apply it to a movie to remember it. So as the services are winding down, you said they're wanting to keep these cores that they can build from going forward. So what options were open for women who wished to join the new U.S. Air Force as it was coming into place? What could a woman do should she want to volunteer to be in the Air Force?
So there were mostly just administrative roles. In many cases, women actually did fewer things in the WAF than they did when they were back during World War II. So they had mm-hmm. fewer options open to them. Most of the options were administrative in nature. There were some women who were doing things that might be considered more operational jobs, like air traffic controller. But mm-hmm. as time passed in the 1950s, a lot of those jobs were taken away from women. Women were actually removed from them. And there was one instance where Jean Holm, who's one of the main characters in the book, she was made into kind of an operational planning job, and that was later removed from her because it was like, oh no, that's too operational. You know, you need to be an admin mm-hmm. kind of person, and she wasn't happy with that, but she wanted to continue serving. Some women did serve in intelligence positions.
So I guess the thing we need to sort of delve into really there, because you've mentioned that operational role, because that starts getting close to the big barrier, which is a combat role. So the ban on women being in combat, he says, doing air quotes, what was that definition that is basically going to be the crux of our conversation next while? So what involved a combat role? Because you'd think an operational planning role would not be in the firing line, but it was an excuse to move
right
the laser general home, spoiler there, ladies and gentlemen, out of that spot.
So there was two pieces. One was just a policy piece mm-hmm. where the services didn't use women in certain jobs, and the other piece was a law. So in 1948, when they passed the law that stood up the women's organizations on a permanent basis, they also, as part of that law, included in that law that women were not allowed to fly combat aircraft or engage the enemy in a combat aircraft. So, and then they also could not serve on combat ships, which by the Navy's classification, pretty much every ship, you know, was a combat ship. You know, there were a few, but most of them were combat ships. So that was the law that didn't allow them in combat. Now, they talked about putting something in place for the Army as well, but the Army, it was a lot harder to say, you know, what they couldn't do. And in the Air Force mm-hmm. In the Navy, it was easy to say no combat airplanes, no combat ships, you know, but the Army's a little bit more diverse in what they have. So the Army just agreed that by policy, we won't let women into combat jobs. And they were the ones that got to define what a combat job was. And Congress kept a close eye on them. The Air Force and the Navy, of course, then by policy, you know, just decided what other jobs they were going to allow women to do or not to do. So
I guess it's hindsight. You look back and you can kind of see the problems from the very beginning, because you're saying that's 1948. They're defining that over the next few years, figuring it out. And then Korea happens. How does that start adding to the problems of what a definition is? Because it's, that is a specific war that we kind of remember being quite stale, but the front line on that for what a role would be is quite blurry, isn't it?
Well, Korea was, yeah, okay. Korea was most, I mean, they had more of a front line than they did, say, in Vietnam. So, but the way the military dealt with Korea was they just didn't allow women to go into the theater except for nurses. Mm. So that was, they kept all the women stateside. And that was, you know, very frustrating for a lot of women. You had like women who worked in intel, you know, intelligence, who really wanted to go over to theater and help. And other women, you know, even in just support roles, wanted to go, and they were not allowed to do so. Which, again, now you've got a very valuable part of your force that wants to go help, and they're not even allowed to show up. So,
is it about this time that our friend Jackie Cochran appears back in the scene?
Oh, yes.
It's about after Korea when they start looking at things again. She seems the right person to bring in to help on the review of women in the service. She doesn't really, does she?
No, she, you know, there's, it's not 100% clear that she was who various people wanted to actually lead the WAF once it was stood up, but she did not lead the WAF. And it's not 100% clear exactly why that happened. Did she not want the job? You know, were there other people that didn't like her? You know, that sort of a thing. But for whatever reason, she didn't lead the WAF. But not, you know, within a few years after they stood up, they were starting to have some issues. Nothing major, but it was more like I would consider benign neglect. It wasn't that they had poor leadership or anything like that. It was just the Air Force, the rest of the Air Force wasn't paying that much attention to what they were doing and giving them the resources they really needed. And so Hoyt Vandenberg, who was the chief staff of the Air Force at the time, brought in Jacqueline Cochran to do a review of the WAF. And she did a very, I would call superficial review. She went down to Lackland Air Force Base, which is where they have their basic training. And the women had a lot of issues with uniforms after the war, because you're transitioning not only from the service, you know, one service to another, but you now are having to develop uniforms for, you know, women that haven't existed before, you know, on the Air Force. And so there were some contracting issues and various issues and of getting the uniforms. And so the women at Lackland at that time had kind of a mishmash of uniforms. And so, you know, by definition, uniforms are supposed to be the same, right? You know, but that wasn't the case. And in some cases, the uniforms were, you know, old, and they didn't fit very well. And so anyway, Cochran, you know, basically reported back that, you know, she reported that the WAF were recruiting a bunch of misfits and they all looked terrible and, you know, and using a lot of very offensive language, you know, towards these women who were just trying to do the best they could. And anyway, the report wound up getting leaked into the press. And of course, the press had a field day with it, especially if it had been anybody else, they probably wouldn't have paid much attention to it. But here's Jacqueline Cochran, you know, and so it's a big deal.
Because on the other side, you mentioned her briefly a moment ago, is Jean Holm. She's a fascinating character, someone who, there's points in your book where you can almost feel her frustration sort of oozing off the page. But she seems to be the perfect person to lead the WAF and to have the battles that open the doors for what comes later. She seems a remarkable lady.
Yes, she was.
That's a very open question. Yeah, she seems remarkably. Yes, let's move on. Can you tell us a little bit more about her?
Yeah, so unfortunately, she was. Well, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but you know, when the early battles were going on, she was still very young, and so she wasn't really a part of those early battles. And she was off in the field, you know, like working over in Germany and doing other things. And so it wasn't until I think the late 50s that she kind of got back to the Pentagon and. About the mid 50s that she got back to the Pentagon and started moving up in rank. And, you know, her timing was actually perfect because about the time that she was finally at an age and grade where she could become the chief of the WAF, take over the WAF, she, you know, that was also the time that coincided with Vietnam. and with the women's movement starting up. And so, you know, prior to that, I think a woman trying to do the things that she did would probably have not been well accepted, you know, within the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. She would have been told to go shut up and color, you know. but, you know, it was the mid-60s by the time she got in. And I think that, you know, part of it was her own personality, but it also, I think a lot of it was timing. You know, she had the right timing to be able to start, you know, pounding on her high chair, if you will, you know, and saying, hey, things need to change. You know, we've got all these women and we need to give them more opportunities. They want to serve in Vietnam. There's no reason they shouldn't get to serve in Vietnam. And, you know, and just all of the various issues that women were dealing with at that time, she was a very strong proponent in getting a lot of things fixed for women.
Because Vietnam seems to be that sort of watershed. It's, you know, the note there really about a war without a front line. There's that great line in your book as well, as one of the generals in Germany stating, well, if something happens here, they're all going to be on the front line anyway.
Right, right. Well,
how does Vietnam and the complexities of the conflict there, how does that start changing the way that women can be seen to be deployed and how that opens more doors as we start moving forward into the 70s?
I think there was a couple things in Vietnam. You know, like you mentioned, some of it was no real front lines for the most part. So you had, you know, if women were on a base, for example, doing an administrative job, they were just as vulnerable to, say, a rocket attack, you know, as the men were. And there were some real ironies in Vietnam. You had women serving over there who were civilians. You had women who were, you know, Red Cross volunteers, USO volunteers. You had women all over the place over there. And yet initially they weren't letting military women go. It's like, this is crazy. You know, why are they any more vulnerable than these other women that are allowed to come over? And so eventually that did change. So I think the other thing, though, that was different about Vietnam was the amount of television. You know, it was very much a not a televised war, but there was film that came over every day from Vietnam. I mean, I grew up during the 1960s, and my dad was actually in Vietnam. And I remember watching the nightly news, you know, every night there was something from Vietnam, and there was usually footage that had come over, you know, and it was usually a couple days old by then, because they had to fly everything over in those days. But they would have footage of everything that was happening. So I think the public, you know, that was the first time the public really had a lot of insight into what was going on in the war. And I don't know how much they actually saw women serving, you know, in Vietnam. But there were certainly newspaper articles about women that were serving over there. I mean, it was, I think, becoming more obvious to the public that, you know, that warfare is changing and there are women in the military. So it was kind of that first, first movement, I guess, if you will, you know, towards what happened later in the Gulf War and, you know, the 70s and 80s and then leading up to the Gulf War, which eventually kicked open the door. So, yeah.
Because you have women serving on the regular airlift flights. You have, I talked to Julia Cook about the Pan Am stewardesses flying the flights in and out of Saigon and other places as well. So as you said, there's a lot of women involved in various roles there. So this is kind of the point where you yourself enter the story. And I have a couple questions I'd like to ask you before we get on to the academy and things like that. For someone growing up in the Vietnam era, as someone who is completely removed from that sort of environment, why the Air Force for you? I've sprung that on you, and I apologize, but it was, as I was looking at this earlier, I said, I haven't actually asked that question. So I this is all lead up for me just begging you to tell me about the F4, but we'll get to that again later. But I was thinking about this. I was just intrigued to sort of get your viewpoint as what drew you to the Air Force.
So, you know, this is a question I always have a little bit of trouble answering, because I actually joined the Air Force mostly because I was just looking to do something different. I was up in the Seattle area. I had graduated from college. I was working as a computer programmer and I just was wanting to do something a little bit different. And I looked around and and the Air Force recruiter was recruiting at the University of Washington, and I went and talked with them. And yeah, initially, I was just going to let's just see what this is all about. And I chose the Air Force to talk to because my dad had been in the Air Force, so I was familiar with the Air Force. And but I wasn't like just dying to join or anything. I just went and wanted to talk for a few minutes. And the next thing I knew, I was filling out all this paperwork and getting my physical. And the next thing I knew, I was off to officer training school. And I thought, well, I'll just go do this for a few years and see how it works out. And it worked out just fine. I found out that I really liked it and I was pretty good at it, and so I hung around.
And you went sort of the engineering track, and you still how does a computer programmer end up being an engineering? We'll call you a test pilot because that's basically how does that happen? Because we're going to get into as your book really goes into a lot of detail about the women in flying roles, but front seat flying roles. But before them, there was the likes of your good self blasting great big holes in the sky in the back seats of F4s and things. We're going to come back to, I love that thing. What sort of journey is that on? Because, again, that seems operational. And, again, we're still in a period where, to a lot of senior commanders, operational means combat. How did you find that experience as you made your way in your early part of your career?
So test airplanes are not considered combat airplanes. They're not combat coded, which is a term the military uses for airplanes that will actually deploy and go into combat. They're usually pre-production versions, or they're heavily modified for flight testing, and so they're not considered combat airplanes. And so therefore, women can fly in them. So and actually, women have long been able to fly like in the backseat of various even combat coded airplanes. The Air Force has long, and Navy have long, taken reporters, up for flights, or, people in Congress. And they never limited that, based on gender. So it wasn't so much that women couldn't fly in combat aircraft, they couldn't fly them in combat. And so why would you train somebody to fly a combat airplane if they're not going to fly in combat, right? So that was kind of the way the Air Force viewed it. So, and the Navy to some extent as well. So
I guess if you're wanting to be involved in that sort of frontline flying, the engineering track is the one you would follow at that time, was it?
Right. Because yes, because women couldn't fly in combat aircraft. And so there was a woman, Leslie Kenny, and she actually went to test pilot school as a flight test engineer back in the mid-70s, because the women couldn't even go to pilot training at that time when she first came into the Air Force. So she was the first woman to go through test pilot school as a flight test engineer. So,
what is what is test pilot school like? Because it's as someone who's just spent an absolute fortune on a new copy of The Right Stuff with pictures and things in it, we have a very fixed idea of the place we all want to go, Edwards, and look at stuff. What was your experience of the test school?
So the curriculum is very similar depending, no matter whether you're a pilot or a navigator or an engineer, there's several different, specialties in the Air Force that go through the school. So, and no matter what one of those specialties that you're in, the academics is exactly the same. Typically the way they do something is you learn the academics about behind something, and then climb performance. You'll learn the academics behind that, and then you will plan a test mission, and you'll go out and collect data in some airplane, T-38, F-16, C-12. There's different airframes that they use. And then you analyze that data, and you either write a report on it, then maybe it's coming up with some kind of a short report, or it becomes an input to a larger report. And you do that repeatedly. you do that again and again and again and again. And where the difference between, say, pilot and flight test engineer arises is when you go out and you fly, the pilot flies in the front seat and the engineer flies in the back seat or the back end, depending upon what kind of an airplane you're in. And then also there may be flights where the pilot is flying in the air and the engineer is sitting in a control room on the ground. So, so that's the main difference, is the courses are very similar. It's just a matter of where you're flying in the airplane or whether you're flying at all.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we're at the Pima Air and Space Museum with our Lucian IL-2 Sturmovik. The Sturmovik was the most produced military aircraft in history with 36,000 built. It's an interesting aircraft that it's made out of multiple different materials. The cockpit and the engine is all kind of behind armored steel. The inner wing is kind of aluminum like you'd expect, and then the outer wing is all made out of wood with metal struts and obviously metal fixtures and stuff. And the rear fuselage is also made out of wood, with the horizontal being made out of metal and the vertical being wood and metal and fabric. These aircraft could take up quite a bit of punishment. You know, they were designed to just kind of get in there and protect their aircrew from ground attack fire, whether it was, you know, 20-millimeter cannons or machine guns or light weaponry. They had bomb bays underneath the wings where the weapons, where the bomb bays were. They had rocket slots out on the wings for rails for rockets. They had cannons in the wings and also machine guns. The cockpit is, if you notice, the front windshield is made out of laminated armored glass, and the thing is ridiculously thick. This aircraft itself was restored from a wreck from a lake in Russia near Leningrad. This aircraft was shot down on, well, I was going to say on its last mission. It was obviously its last mission, but it was shot down near the end of the siege of Leningrad. It was during winter. Looking at the recovered wreck, it looks like it took some fire in the radiator cooler vent there on the bottom, which probably caused the engine to overheat. So they made an emergency landing on a frozen lake. The crew got out. It ended up sinking in the lake after the ice melted. And then back in the 88 or 89, the Russian Navy recovered this aircraft, because this actually did fly with the Russian Navy, not the Russian Air Force, but they were all doing the same thing around Leningrad. It's not like this thing was, you know, slinging torpedoes around. But it got recovered, all the metal bits. The original tires were still on the aircraft with air in the inner tubes, which those we have taken off of the tires and put them away to put on display eventually when we do a more thorough display about the Sturmovik and the Eastern Front and this aircraft in particular. But it was an interesting story long before I started working here at the museum. I think sometime in the late 90s or so, or early 2000s, the museum was called up. This woman, her husband had passed away. I think he lived out in California, if I recall correctly. It was like, we have an airplane in our hangar. Do you want it? And we're like, well, what type of aircraft is it? Well, the last thing anyone expected was that this guy had a Sturmovik sitting in his garage. So, as I said, it was all the metal bits. The landing gear was still retracted in there. There was air in the tires. A few years ago, we started going in the restoration. We hired a gentleman in Germany who had plans. He built the wooden wood parts. He built the wooden fuselage. Rear fuselage, shipped it out, and his woodworker came out here and built up the two wings, and then we kind of cleaned it up as best as, you know, could, and used all the original parts and made it the, well, actually at this point, the only Sturmovik on public display here in the United States. There's one in private hands, and the Smithsonian is apparently working on theirs as well, probably because, you know, since we got ours, somebody wanted to get theirs done.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And now, back to the show. Okay, I'm going to ask it. What was your first flight in an F4 like?
I don't actually really remember it that well. it's funny. I think when you've flown a lot, you kind of stop, remembering all these kinds of things. But I do remember how powerful it was. It was because I had flown, in a few, I'd flown in a lot of smaller airplanes, obviously, and I'd flown in a T-38 at that point. And I just remember how powerful it was, the acceleration down the runway. I remember the afterburner kicking in. The afterburner on a T-38, you hardly even notice it. You put in the afterburner, it's kind of like, and the F4, you can really feel it kicking you in the back, as you're boom, 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 as you're going down the runway. So yeah, it was, that was probably the main thing. And just, I was surprised at how well it flew, it's an older airplane. I was kind of expecting it to be hard to fly, but it's actually, I got a little bit of stick time on it. And I remember being impressed with how easy it actually was to fly. I was a little bit afraid of it, kind of intimidated, but turned out to be actually very easy to fly airplane.
Because that's one of your, is it 20, 25 types that you've got in your book?
Yeah, about 25.
In your logbook, this?
Yeah, it's about...
I'm picking that one because I love it. It's fantastic. And it's one of those aircraft that did everything as it had to and then lasted forever. It's just one of those... iconic. Anyways, we're getting off track, right? Because as you're joining the Air Force, there's interesting changes happening. There's the debates going on in Congress about opening up the academies, but you also have the Air Force saying that they're going to take a group to as a test pool to see if women can fly. That's a terrible way of putting it, but I guess that was the feeling within the Air Force. What was that first group of women like? Because one of your characters in there is Kathy Rambo, who seems just the most remarkable lady. What was their experience like being, saying the first is a terrible way of putting it, but they really were a group that all eyes were upon.
Yeah, they were the first, and that actually happened a few years before I came in. I came in 1980, so a lot of
I'm blending stuff in so that we can chat about you. All these fantastic people. I'm making sure you're front and center. Yeah. You're the guest.
But that if I could just digress just a bit, that was one of the reasons I came into the Air Force. Initially, I was not interested in the Air Force or any military service because when I graduated from high school in 1974. Women couldn't go to the academy. They couldn't be pilots. I guess they were just starting to open Navy, Navy pilots to women. But there were very few options for women when I graduated from high school. But then, 6 years later, when I was looking for something else to do, everything had changed, And so it seemed like a better opportunity at that time. So, but getting back to the first women, the Air Force finally decided in the fall of 1975 to open up pilot training to women. And initially, the first class of 10 women, actually, I think the first two classes of 10 women each, they wanted it to be women who were already in the Air Force. So it had to be somebody who, say, was already a nurse in the Air Force or an administrative officer or a maintenance officer, something like that. So Kathy Rambo was actually still an ROTC cadet at the time at the University of Oklahoma, and she wanted to go to pilot training, and she was very disappointed to find out that they were only going to be taking women who were already on active duty. But it turned out there was a loophole, and the reserve, our reserve component, was being allowed to send somebody to pilot training. And so she applied for that reserve slot, and the reservist said, sure, we'll take you. And so she was able to join that class, even though she was a brand new second lieutenant. But that the first group of women that went through, everything, I think there, a lot of it was they weren't quite sure what to do, with the women's hair and the flight suits didn't fit right, and a lot of those things were actually still issues when I was, when I was going through, believe it or not. So yeah, there's still issues in some cases. So yeah, but But yeah, there was a lot of initial, I think, consternation about, you know, women wearing makeup and, you know, will it interact with the oxygen and cause problems and what kind of, you know, just all kinds of things that they were very concerned about, most of which turned out, of course, not to be a big deal. But like the women showed up initially and had to cut their hair short. They weren't allowed to put it up, you know, with bobby pins and that sort of a thing. And so they just kind of, I think they kind of had to feel their way through things. And there were things, I'm sure there were things that came up as they were going through that, you know, nobody had anticipated. Well, what do we do about this? You know, that sort of thing. And then, of course, there was always, you know, the concerns about, you know, with what if one of them gets pregnant, you know, and, you know, they're going to get grounded, they won't be able to fly. And so there was, you know, a lot of things that we know how to deal with today because we've been dealing with them for 40, 50 years. But things that were brand new then and not quite sure in a lot of cases what to do.
We're going to come back to the pregnancy bit at the end, but because that's really changed. Yeah. But we have this in, well, I'm going to call them intrepid because they're fantastic. I keep saying careers. What can they end up doing? Because again, we get into this combat barrier. What could their trajectory be for aircraft that they could fly once they've got their wings, once they've proved their mettle? It's an interesting conundrum that starts taking a while to figure out, doesn't it?
So initially, because of the combat exclusion law, we call it, they were not allowed to fly in fighters or bombers. They were restricted to flying in, say, transport aircraft, or cargo airplanes, refueling tankers, aeromedical evacuation, things like that. So you're basically your support aircraft. And so it didn't matter how good they were. In fact, Connie Engel was graduated number one in her class. Normally, if she had been a male, she would have been allowed to go fly a fighter if that's what she'd wanted. And she wasn't allowed to do that. So she did get to stay as an instructor flying in the T-38, which is the, you know, high-performance supersonic aircraft. But that was about the best a woman could do in those days if she wanted to continue flying high-performance airplanes, was to become a T-38 instructor. You know, otherwise, she was going to go fly C-141 cargo airplanes one of many airplanes that were available to them, but, you know, airplanes that were in a support role. And I want to clarify, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there are lots of those airplanes are very important, you know, but if you graduate at the top of your class and you want to be a fighter pilot, you know, that was very frustrating for a lot of women who did very well and, you know, by right should have been, you know, able to get a fighter, but because the law couldn't.
100%. Yep. That probably didn't make that as clear. So let's just take a, before we get back to the flying proper, the academies opening up was quite a change that took quite a while for them all to figure themselves out. And the US Air Force Academy being the youngest of the academies, we could say, they resisted. And they kept a lot of the sort of traditions, like the Bring Me Men ramp. You know, Kim Campbell talks about that still being there in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And you thought that would have changed. What did the Air Force find when they opened up the academy to women after, Jimmy Carter signed that one through?
Well, it was 1976. It was actually Ford that signed the legislation that opened the academy. So women started, the first class entered in 1976. So the first classes did. So, I can't really speak to the other academies. I've read a little bit about them, but, you know, mostly I focus on the Air Force Academy. I think one of the big things that Air Force did was they really did, I think, try to do what they thought was the right thing to bring the women in and have them be comfortable. So, and, you know, they wanted to give them every chance to succeed. They brought in women from active duty to, you know, kind of be mentors for them. Women who, of course, hadn't gone through the academy themselves. here they are now trying to mentor women who are going through the academy. So a little bit of a conundrum there, but, one of the things that they did that in some ways was good, in some ways was bad, was initially, because there were not that many women, there were about 150 to start, you know, out of a class of, you know, there's about, I think, 14 or 1500 that come in. So a fair, you know, fairly small number of women. Initially, there was a lot of concerns about having them be with the men all the time, you know, and especially in the dormitories. And the Air Force has multiple dormitories. And so what their solution was to put all the women in the same dormitory. And they were kind of a little bit away from the rest, from the men. So, you know, it wasn't like they could just walk across the street. You know, they were a little bit further away. And in some ways that was good because the women became very close. They created this very tight bond. But at the same time, they were missing out on what was going on, the informal interactions and bonding that you get with your, you know, with your squadron. So they were assigned to squadrons, you know, within the academy. But they never saw them except in the daytime. In the evenings, when they went back to their dorm rooms, they never saw, you know, it was just the men and then the women. And the men and the women didn't interact in the evening and have those, you know, casual conversations and really feel like the women were part of the team. And so they actually, to their credit, the Air Force Academy recognized that early on, that, you know, there was this good piece of it, but that it was really hampering their ability to be part of the team. And so after the Christmas break, they came back and they moved all the women into the dorms and integrated them in. And, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, they just had to take a few bathrooms and relabel them as ladies' rooms, you know. and they had some, I think initially they, if I remember right, I think initially they were all like on the same floor, you know, and then later they just moved around. And, you know, obviously they don't share rooms, you know, but now they're all just pretty much integrated. And so they found that worked a lot better, and everybody was able to become a better team as a result of that.
It's an interesting time because as that first class is graduating in the early 80s, when you're joining the Air Force, you mentioned it, you know, the ongoing problems with kit and things like that. When you look back on your early years in the Air Force, are there things that just make you sort of shake your head and go, how did we get through with that stuff?
You know, I'd say not so much. I mean, a lot of the equipment issues, you know, part of it is in many cases, if something fit really bad, a lot of the times the Air Force would, you know, pay to do some custom, like they would pay for a custom oxygen mask. Everybody got a custom helmet. Didn't matter if you were a man or a woman, you know, so there was, I think they really did their best to accommodate, and they weren't going to say anything. You know, I never wound up modifying my flight suit, but I know women that did, and they're not going to say anything, you know, as long as it remains functional and it doesn't, you know, it's not obvious what you did, you know, like if you added a bunch of new zippers, you know, they might go, not so sure about that. But they actually allow a fair amount of, you know, tailoring, if you will, to get something so that it's functional. So, and some of it, you know, in their defense, I mean, there was such a small number of women, I think, in those days, that it was hard to justify, you know, creating a whole new series of equipment, you know, just for the small number of women. I think it was more economical just to do the customization for the women who really needed it. So.
The 80s are an interesting time. You have a new president in Ronald Reagan. You have the military buildup there. You also have some, I'm going to call them very specific conflicts. So you have the likes of Grenada, Libya, Panama, the bombing in Beirut as well. But all of those see women being thrust into frontline roles again. How did those conflicts really start to push that combat embargo back and start showing that there wasn't really, I'm going to say, a need for the embargo, but showing that for operational capability to be as high as it is, the women had an equal role to play?
I think a good example of that is, you know, Margie Clark, who I talk about in the book, is she was flying C-1. She was, first of all, she was one of the first women to graduate from the Air Force Academy. And then she went to pilot training. She was flying C-141 cargo airplanes out of Charleston, South Carolina. And she flew into Beirut the day after the bombing there. You know, flew a bunch of army troops into there. It was still a very hostile area. And if she had been removed from the schedule, somebody would have had to bring they would have had to bring a male pilot in whose turn was not to fly that day, right? You know, they might have been, you know, relaxing at home, you know, having their day off, and they would have been called in to fly. So not only would it have not been fair to her, you know, for her to not be able to go fly, it wouldn't have been fair to the male pilot that they had to pull in to replace her. And the same thing happened just a few days later when the U.S. invaded Grenada. She was on the schedule, and so she went in, even though it was a hostile area, she went in and flew, and it was the same thing. You know, they would have had to pull a male pilot in if they had decided to pull her off the schedule. But she was perfectly capable of flying, and she was, mm-hmm. you know, the best person to take the job because she was already scheduled to fly. That didn't happen to some women who were in on a base on the West Coast in California. Their commander said, no, that's combat. You women are all coming off the schedule, and they brought a bunch of men in to replace them. So, you know, so it's creating churn in the schedule, and it's really not fair to anybody to do that. It's disrupting, you know, your normal, you know, your normal capability, if you will. So it was things like that that I think started to make people realize that you know, telling us that we can't have women in combat can be disruptive to our schedule. It's unevenly applied, right? Because on the East Coast, the commanders all went, the women are on the schedule, go, you know. On the West Coast, they went, nope, pull the women off, you know. And so, you know, created those disruptions. And so, you know, I think those were some of the earliest cracks that people started to realize that the combat laws, the way they were written, you know, might have maybe worked great when you have a very definite front line and, you know, you're fighting in trenches and things like that. But when you have modern warfare without well-defined front lines, and you've got these small operations that, you know, happen very quickly, you go in, you come back out, that these definitions of combat no longer really apply. And so trying to now fit women not being able to fly into combat into this mold no longer works.
And you start getting those really interesting situations that we'd see in the Libya operation with the tankers being planned by women, flown by women, fueling up the bombers going in, which again would just be amplified come Desert Storm a little bit later. And I thought the Libya example that you have in your book was utterly fascinating, of just how prominent women were in not only in the planning and the execution of it, but sort of seeing, you know, again, surely fueling something to go is as combat as going. Yeah, it's an intellectual exercise that the Air Force clearly were struggling with themselves.
Oh, yeah. And then, you know, in theory, you're not in combat because you're not going into the actual area that's being bombed, but you're still sitting out there in an orbit. And if somebody figures out there that you're there and that you're refueling those bombers, they can much more easily go after you. You're very vulnerable than go after the planes that are dropping the bombs. And if you, you know, as I think there's a famous quote in the book, if you get the tankers, you've got the bombers, right? You know, because now the bombers don't have enough fuel to either get to their target or they're all going to run out of gas on the way home. So, you know, and the Air Force recognized that women were going to be in perilous situations. I mean, the women had to go through survival training and, you know, escape evasion training, all of that, just like the men. So, you know, even though they weren't going into combat, and I put that in quotes, they still had to go all through all of that same training. So the Air Force recognized that women were potentially going to be in perilous situations.
I just read Eileen Collins' book, and the survival course just seemed horrible.
Yeah.
As someone with terribly soft hands, it just seems, it seems the worst. The other thing that starts cropping up is not being, again, combat capable, whatever we want to call it. That was having an effect on the career progression that some of the more senior women in the Air Force were having as well at this time, wasn't it? So what were those sort of career limitations that being in non-combat roles were having upon some of the higher ranked?
So clearly there's, you know, career progression for all career fields in the Air Force. And there's a lot of people who make general officer without being, you know, without even being pilots, right? So so there's career progression. But the problem is that as you get more and more senior, that the most of the highest ranked positions go to people who have combat experience or are in some kind of combat role. I mean, if you look at all of the past chiefs of staff of the Air Force, you know, all men, all fighter or bomber pilots, you know, combat role kinds of pilots. And if you look around again at the highest ranks, you know, you start looking at the 2 and 3 star generals, you know, again, you start to get, you know, more and more positions that are, you know, kind of, they really favor people that have combat experience or experience in the combat arms, you know, even if they don't have actual combat experience. So, you know, they've been through that training and they understand how that all works. And that becomes much more valuable at the higher ranks. And so initially it wasn't that big of a deal. You know, it, when you're a captain, you're not really thinking that much about being a 4-star general, right? You know, but you're just doing your job. But as women started to get promoted into the higher ranks, you know, major, lieutenant, colonel, they started to realize that, oh, wait a minute, you know, because I'm not in in a combat position, that's probably going to limit my, the upper end of where I can get to. You know, I probably am not going to be able to get into those best jobs and be able to achieve those higher ranks. For a lot of women, that doesn't really matter. You know, a lot of people just want to put in their 20 years and retire as a lieutenant colonel, or perfectly happy retiring as a colonel. But for women who want to aspire to the best jobs and the highest ranks, you know, it was a limiting factor.
So the war in the Gulf, Desert Shield, Desert Storm, really starts putting a very direct focus on operations as a whole. Just how involved were the women in the Air Force in the planning and the build up to Desert Storm? Because we've already been talking about them being quite prominent within the transport logistics roles. As that incredible build up happened in late 1990, what sort of roles were being carried out by women and what was their experience in an environment that doesn't take kindly to women in prominent positions? I think it's a polite way of describing it.
So the women actually were involved in, you know, all aspects of the buildup and then the actual shooting war as well, except for, you know, actually going into the combat area and dropping bombs and that sort of thing. It was a logistics war, you know, taking, you know, thousands of tons and maybe millions of tons. I'm not even sure what the right number is, but, you know, there were just thousands and thousands of flights going over from the United States, you know, into Europe and on into the Middle East for months on end, carrying cargo and troops and supplies and, you know, just all of the things that, that we needed, you know, to set the stage in order to actually have the war when it did kick off. And a lot of those pilots were women. And it's not just the pilots, it's all the other crew members. It's your navigators, your loadmasters, your flight engineers, your linguists, you know, all of these, your tankers, your boom operators, you know, all of these women were, you know, women were concentrated in those aircraft. And those were the main show for, you know, the first 6 months of the buildup until everything finally got into place where the combat could actually start. So women, women played an outsized role in the, you know, in that buildup period. And there was also another factor was that a lot of women by then were senior enough that they had decided to move into the reserves, and the reserves were activated during the war. So a lot of women, in addition to the women that were on active duty, you had a lot of women who were in the reserve squadrons, and they were activated and were flying over there as well and taking part in all of that. And you know, I think that for the most part, the men, the you know, the Western men were fine with the presence of the women, but some of the you know, some of the men in Saudi Arabia itself were you know, not so comfortable with their presence, and there were issues with the women. You know, if they wanted to go off base, you know, having to, you know, wear a scarf over their head, they weren't allowed to drive. In some cases, the host country would separate the men and the women. They would put the men in tents and they would put the women in a hotel 5 miles away, which doesn't, you know, if you're trying to keep your crew together so that you can all get together early in the morning and brief and go fly, you know, it's not very conducive to that. But, you know, I think overall, you know, overall, I think the women, you know, did well, you know, everything considered. And some of the women I talked to said they never actually had any problems when they were in country. But other women, you know, experience some, you know, derogatory remarks or some of the things that I just mentioned.
The, one of the experiences in your book that to jumped out to me was that Sheila Tuning
yes.
on the AOS aircraft. That is the combat paradox writ large, isn't it?
Right.
She is vectoring F-15s onto their target. So therefore, she's playing an active role in combat.
Right.
Yet she cannot be in a combat role.
Right. She can't pull the trigger, but she can tell the pilot how to get there to pull the trigger. Right, right.
So we sort of come out of that time and it's everything is ripe for change, I guess is the way to put it. It's been, no war is positive, but from a victorious standpoint, there's opportunity coming out of it. You have a new president. You have promises being made by Clinton that, many, many promises and other things promised by Clinton that he may or may not have done. That's a different podcast. I can recommend a couple. But what is happening sort of as we hit that sort of middle 90s? Because it's not still not a great environment. You detail that the tailhook scandal as well, which was a shocking thing, really, on the Navy side. But you then have a presidential commission coming in and you have a fantastic organization of women across all the services to start pushing this through. What was that organization and how did they go about making positive change?
So that was the Women Military Aviators. Let me back up just a second because
go for it.
Because what happened initially at the end of the war, the war ended the end of February, and that was right at the time that in the United States they start debating the budget for the next year. So here it was 91. They're starting to debate the budget for 92 in Congress. So perfect timing to slip a provision in to repeal the combat laws. And that's exactly what happened. So I won't dwell on that. You know, there was a little bit of it went very easily through the House side of things. Got a little bit stalled in the Senate, but did eventually pass. But then the Senate also stood up that commission that you mentioned. So and so the commission was to study the roles of women in combat. I put that in quotes because. Many times, if you want to delay something, you study it, right? So that was kind of the thinking by people who didn't want this to happen. So the commission started in the fall of 91, and they went around the country. And the women military aviators were not really involved in the study itself so much. They were more kind of working on the sidelines because they couldn't go like and lobby. You know, they had to be invited to testify. What they could do though is work behind the scenes, you know, getting in touch with the people who were, working administratively with the commission. Like each one of the services had a liaison to the commission. And I talk about, you know, one of the men, Mike Lynch, who played that role. And so the women, you know, the WMA could, get in touch with these liaisons and, you know, perhaps suggest topics that they could talk about or here's some women who would be good to testify, that sort of a thing. So they played kind of a behind the scenes role in that. So but earlier they had played a much bigger role in educating members of Congress as to why they needed to repeal this law in the first place. And then they continued to play a role during the commission, you know, again, writing to their Congress people, you know, writing to various folks and working within the system, to try to get the policy changed. Because once the law was lifted, it didn't automatically open the door because the service still had the policies in place to keep women from flying in combat. And so, again, they continued to, like I said, it was mostly behind the scenes at that point, as opposed to being very, vocal.
So policy change, I guess it's like a process. No, in large organizations, nobody likes change. And no matter how small or how big, it's a hurdle to jump. When does the Air Force finally, Ben, because you've got the fantastic General Merrill McPeak, who's against it until he has no other choice but to support it. When is that sort of defining moment when I keep wanting to say ban. It's the wrong word, isn't it? You said the term a second ago.
Combat exclusion.
Exclusion.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah,
ban's the wrong thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when does the policy on the combat exclusion lift, and what happens.
Yeah, so this really was the Clinton administration coming in. So because the commission finished up its report just at the exact same time that the election was going on in the United States between George Bush and Bill Clinton. And the commission actually recommended that combat roles remain closed to women. So that was not good. So, but that same time, Bill Clinton was elected president. And the report was just a recommendation, right? You know, you can ignore any recommendation you want. And he had pledged to open up combat to women. Now, unfortunately, you know, it didn't happen I think there was a lot of hope that, okay, Bill Clinton's in office now, you know, the end of January, and pretty soon everything's going to open up, and still things kind of dragged. The service chiefs were still against opening the combat aircraft. And as you mentioned, Merrill McPeak was probably the most vocal of all of them, you know, saying that he didn't want women to be flying combat aircraft. You know, it was one of those things where it was going to happen, right? I think everybody knew it was going to happen. It was just a matter of when is Les Aspin, the Secretary of Defense, going to, you know, stand up and say, okay, women are now going to be allowed in combat. And that finally happened on April 28th, 1993. There are some people, and I believe that this is probably at least some of what forced it to finally happen, because initially Aspin had said that he would make a decision by the fall. But the Tailhook report, as you mentioned, the Tailhook that happened in the fall of 1991, very scandalous event, you know, women molested, you know, and, you know, assaulted, all this kind of stuff. And the investigation into that was about to become public. And that was in the April timeframe. And there was some thinking that the Navy was getting very, very nervous about this thing going public. And there was some thinking that the Navy wanted to go ahead and open up a combat to women is kind of to kind of help, I think, soften the blow of the Tailhook report. And I don't know if any of that's actually true. I mean, there might, those two events may be totally disconnected, But it
sounds like a usual political move,
right? Right. So yeah,
scandal over here. Let's do something positive. Over here.
Yeah. We know this is going to happen anyway, and this other really bad thing is about to happen. So let's do something really good. You know, right? So anyway, for whatever reason, you know, whatever the politics were and everything, then, you know, Les Aspin, and obviously the services knew ahead of time that was going to happen. You know, they probably knew at least a few days, you know, maybe even a couple of weeks ahead of time that this was going to happen, that he was going to announce that he was going to open it. And so, so General McPeak, you know, he was, he had always said, hey, if they open it up, you know, I will implement the policy, you know, I'll shut up and salute and go implement the policy. And so he wanted to be the first, right? Okay. Now, but if you're going to make me do it, I'm going to at least, you know, lead the pack. And so, so he identified the first, three women fighter pilots. Actually, he identified seven women who were going to be the first pilots before April 28th. And then he got the first three of them to come up on stage with him and announce to the world that we're opening combat, opening fighter airplanes to women. And here's the first three.
As someone you'd have been in for about 10 years by that point, wouldn't you? What was that moment like for you when you saw, I've got the picture here.
Yeah.
In your book.
Yeah.
Who have we got? So we've got Captain Sharon Presler, we've got Captain Martha McSally, mm-hmm. and Lieutenant Jean Flynn. What was that like for you as a woman with decent service under her belt to see women finally getting into the F-15, which still is the aircraft of choice, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I was just thrilled. So, you know, I don't remember actually watching it on TV or anything. I was actually going to school at that time, Air Command and Staff College. So, you know, it's not one of those moments that I remember where I was, you know, when I heard about the announcement. And plus, I think, you know, we'd just been talking about it for so long, you know, and it just became,
it's done great.
Yeah, I think it was kind of like that. But, you know, I do remember being very happy. You know, I remember thinking, it's about time, you know, and I knew women who wanted to fly fighters, and you know, a lot of them, it wasn't going to make a difference because they were too old by then. But there were younger women who, you know, were going to be able to take advantage of that. And I was very happy for them.
throughout your book, we get to meet some truly remarkable women. We've only mentioned a couple specifically because the book is fantastic, dear listener. And go out and grab yourself a copy because I whizzed through it in a couple of sittings. It's fantastic. But it's been, 25 years now?
30.
Nearly little 30. Yeah,
30th goodness. Anniversary is in just a couple of weeks. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So where are we now? Because I think where I'm getting confused is we've had 20 years of continual conflict now with women in prominent roles for that. Is it the norm now, or are there still issues, shall we say, with women in combat, or is it just an accepted thing within the Air Force?
I'd say it's an accepted thing. It's the norm. Women are still small numbers flying in combat mm-hmm. aircraft, but I would say they're accepted. And, I do see, sometimes you see people making a big deal out of things about, a woman doing this or a woman doing that. I hope that we're going to get to the point someday where it's not a big deal that a woman's doing something anymore. But I think generally women, have been accepted in those combat roles, and commanders want the best people for the job. They mm-hmm. don't really care if it's a man or a woman, and like women like to say, the airplane certainly doesn't care if it's a man or a woman flying it, if you've got somebody like Jeannie Flynn, who was the first pilot, first woman fighter pilot, you got somebody like that coming out the very top of her pilot training class. What commander wouldn't want her flying a fighter for him, right? Or her? Yeah. So it just makes sense that you put the best people in the job. So.
And of course, we mentioned her a little bit earlier. We've just had the news a few weeks ago of Lauren Ohm and her husband in the seat next to her in the B-1. And it bugs me that there is a baby in this world, or about to be a baby in this world, who has more time on the B-1 and more time supersonic than I do. Yeah, it seems that, it's, you're right. It feels like it is the norm. And, I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to be talking to Kim Campbell as well.
Oh, good.
And talk about her experience. Funnily enough, my only question about the incident that you open your book with is not really what happened. I want to know what her crew chief said when he saw the aircraft, because I'm glad you're back, ma'am. That's fine. Crew chiefs with broken airplanes are special. Special things. That's next week, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, I'm sure that'll be a great talk.
But it does truly feel enormous. I think you're right. I think for those of us that spend far too much time talking about these things, it's remembering it's pilot. Woman pilot is a redundant term.
Right. It's just a pilot.
It's just a pilot.
Right. That's really what it should be. And that was the thing, that's why I opened my book with that anecdote, was mm-hmm. the fact that we were all talking about this A-10 pilot that got hit and flew her airplane back. And nobody was like, oh my gosh, it was a woman. Obviously it was a her, everybody said her and she, but nobody, nobody batted an eye that it was a woman who'd actually done this. So, yeah.
What was the experience like for you writing this book, getting to go back and see the journey of all sorts of, not just pilots, but women in the Air Force? What's your, book's out now, or will be by the time this goes out. What's your feelings on having gone back and looked at that journey?
I learned a lot, and I'm hoping other people will learn a lot. I lived this, and from 1980 until the door opened and even passed. I didn't retire till 2010, but there was so much I did not know about the history. I knew the general outline of the history. I knew about Jacqueline Cochran. I knew about the WASP. I knew about Jean Holm. Those kinds of things. But there was so much that I didn't know. And the other thing was, there were things going on, especially in the 1980s when I was a young officer. I had that young officer perspective on things. And there were things going on that I didn't interpret right, or I just didn't understand them. And so going back and doing the hard research and really digging into things to really understand what happened and who did what to who, those kinds of things. Like I said, it was very educational, and that was the thing I wanted to do, was put together this whole story, not just the story of the women aviators themselves, but the whole story of everybody that was involved and all of the different attitudes and all of the different things that happened. And like I said, it was never a linear path to get there. You know, it was always this, you know, two steps forward, one step back, you know, sometimes marching in place for a while. You know, it was just, you know, it's just an incredible journey that took, you know, from 1948, you know, all the way up through 1993, you know, to finally make that happen. So.
Well, Eileen, I love going on that journey in your book, so I can't thank you enough for writing it. And I can't thank you enough for spending some time with us talking about it. And I wish you every success with the book, because I'm going to be annoying everybody about it. And so,
well, thank you.
So it's But yes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
I had a fantastic time chatting with Eileen about her career and the women that she came up with. The Fly Girls Revolt, the story of the women who kicked the door open to flying combat, is out next week in the US, published by Knox Press, who very kindly provided a review copy to me, and will be out here in the UK on the 20th of July. I will re-up this episode at that time to get it out, because it really, really is an interesting read. It covers a lot of ground, and you get to meet some remarkable pilots along the way. As always, can't thank Eileen enough. Next week, we talk to Kim Campbell, who's an A-10 pilot. We're going to talk to her about leadership, amongst many other things. We may even discuss that morning over Baghdad, for which she's become rather well known. As always, I can't thank you all enough for your incredible support of the podcast. It's a lot of fun. I'm getting to meet some incredible people, and I hope you're enjoying it as well. Remember, the best way you can share the love is to tell all your friends about this fantastic aviation history podcast, that you're finding out so much amazing, cool stuff. And the host, he's okay as well. Tell your friends, share the links. That is wonderful. And if you can fancy leaving a review or pop some stars into your podcast app of choice, that'd be great too. Of course, there's a Patreon, £3 a month. Links in the description. No pressure on that. If you can, great. You get these early. We throw some of the videos up, pictures from my travels. They all go up on that page. But, you know, hey, get the podcast. That's where the fun is. So, until next time, thank you so much for listening. Oh, one more thing. We have a new website. If you haven't checked it out already, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com. You get all the previous episodes on there with some little fancy new arts. About it, really. There's going to be more things on it as and when I get the time. So check that out. Again, tell your friends, because, you know, why not? Next week, as I said, Kim Campbell, looking forward to that. And as always, please do take care of yourself. The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bowe and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcast and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.